Welcome. I'm Larry Olson. And what's on your mind? Once set, it delivers your life. To change the outcomes we want, we must change the plays we're running. Join us at Mindset Playbook with real people, real talk, for real insight.
Today's episode is sponsored by Apernio, an achievement acceleration company whose approach to professional development enables clients to gain insights and perspectives to live, work, and engage with more success.
I'd like to welcome Bijan Ferhangi, who is the founder and CEO of SammyAid, which is a telehealth company and online healthcare concierge platform. Bijan worked as an executive for several major pharmaceutical companies before opening up a series of medical imaging practices focused on cancer and Alzheimer's disease, which he's since developed significant treatment breakthroughs in each of these areas. He is also a kidney transplant recipient, which we'll get into a little more as we go further along in the interview. Given his years as a healthcare provider, he came to see how the national healthcare system was significantly flawed. It didn't work well for doctors and providers, and it definitely wasn't working adequately for patients. He wanted to do something that no one else could do, and that was to fix healthcare. Thus, SammyAid is the solution. Bijan, you've taken healthcare to another level, and I'm sure it's had its ups and downs. What tipped the scales in your life for you to start such an effective, cost-efficient system to begin with?
Well, I think, you know, anybody who is in this business, right, you're both a patient and an owner at the same time, right? And so I probably took a lot of my own insights into how this can be solved from my own experiences, all the same things I had as a patient. So I try to look at these problems from the consumer or the patient perspective. And of course, running and owning major medical diagnostic imaging centers as well, we could see the problem both from the provider side, which would be the physician's perspective, as well as the patient side, the consumer perspective. And what we noticed was that, one, patients were not getting the kind of care that they could have been getting had they been able to have direct access to the physician. It's a little bit like a situation where the parent wants to talk to the child, but you've got maybe the school as the intermediary, and you cannot directly tell your child what you want or what they want. They can't say what they want from the parent. The parent can't tell the child what they want because they're always dealing with this intermediary. And that intermediary is usually insurance companies. And so we've gone from a system that worked maybe about 100, 150 years ago, or even a lot of countries where it's direct consumer pays for a physician service. There's transparency. The consumer is responsible or can at least get the care that they want. And so the idea was, how do we connect the dots? How do we make healthcare more efficient, more transparent, and more available? It seems like it's one of those tasks that any government bureaucrat would look at and go, impossible. The spaghetti soup of this thing is impossible to solve. Nobody can connect all the dots. However, we sat down and said,
well, let me ask you this. Yeah. Let me ask you this a sec. You know, many, many individuals, when they find out there's no way that we've been doing this so long, we've tried everything, trust me, there is no other way other than the one that we're doing now. So get used to it. Many individuals would have stopped right there. They would have recognized that, you know, as you and I talked a little bit before, that the world's flat. So don't let somebody tell me that that's not the case, because you were up against a lot of tradition and a lot of history. What was it about you that caused you not to be dissuaded by that whole it's impossible kind of mindset?
You know, I don't know. I think it's about whether, I guess if I was a much more complex thinker, or maybe, you know what it is, it's actually like the way you say about being, you know, the tree for the forest kind of analogy, right? If you're too close, you can't see the solution. I tend to kind of always look at these problems from a couple of steps back. And I think that's really helped me kind of look at this. I mean, if I was engaged every day in the fight for healthcare, maybe I would have gotten lost in that morass as well too. But by stepping back, by having a little bit of a a breather. And this has helped not only for this solution for direct supply of healthcare to consumers in a much, much, much better, more cost-effective and more efficient way, but it's also the reason why we were able to come up with a COVID-19 solution that nobody else had, which would have solved this problem from the very get-go. A cancer solution, which is very, very, very straightforward and is a revolution in cancer. And the same thing with Alzheimer's. All these are trying to look at something that is very complex. And again, if I was so close to the problem, if I was looking at this thing from a molecular level, it probably would be way more difficult and way more challenging. But when you back away from the problem and say, look, let's break this problem down as maybe an engineer would to its constituent parts. What's the problem here? Well, if you are able to do that, many, many, many problems just kind of fall away like this.
Okay.
And it's a very simple solution.
Now, where would you say that started to happen for you? If you go back into your life and everyone is getting immersed in trying to resolve things and you get caught up in, I mean, it's like trying to find something out on the internet. You know, one link leads to another link leads in. So pretty soon you're down the rabbit hole. Something was unique about you when you were growing up that gave you this perspective of being able to stand back from it. Can you recall or think about what that may have been or what occurred for you to be able to develop this kind of perspective where you didn't get all caught up in the emotion of it or the complexity?
You know, it's an interesting question where, you know, is it one single moment of epiphany or is it something that evolves over a period of time? And I think I was very lucky in that the environment that I grew up in was a very, very complex environment. I remember one of the interesting questions that I struggled with very early on in life. I grew up in a major international city that had religions from all over the world. You know, every religion was different in coming in. And of course, my own family, I'm half Catholic, Roman Catholic, and half Shiite Muslim. And so I'm in this thing trying to figure out, why do all these people have conflict? Why is there so many different perspectives? And if you just step back from the whole deal, can you boil down the benefits of these different religions to certain five or six or seven common elements? And I did. And I felt like this was one of the ways I could take a problem that is plaguing the world in terms of religious conflict and say, wait a second, we actually have more or greater commonalities than differences. And that was about the age of maybe 10 or 11 and just before the Iranian Revolution. I was actually in Iran during that revolution, going to, you know, a major international school. And from there, you know, everybody's lives flipped up and down and sideways and stuff like that. And so I've always been able to kind of look at a conflict, a major conflict, and try to say, isn't there a simpler way to connect the issues in this conflict? And no matter what it is, I mean, I've always looked at very, very, very large, complex issues and said, I think you break that down into, you know, commonalities. And of course, that actually is, turns out to be a major negotiating skill. When you're negotiating peace talks, when you're negotiating large business deals, when you're negotiating medical programs, at the end of the day, you want to kind of break things down to the simplest commonalities. And at the end, you end up finding that that solves 99% of the problem. You don't solve 100% of the problem, but that last 1 or 2%, I'll leave that to the geniuses. I'll solve the easy stuff, you know, and try to get most of the problems to the step forward and let the last 1 or 2, you know, yards be handled by, you know, the guys at Harvard and Yale and stuff like that. So
that's fantastic. I think, wasn't it Clint Eastwood that said a real man knows his limitations?
There you go. That's right. That's right. That's right. And I have no delusions to that as well. So,
you know, I have a question because you've brought up some very complex and important issues to all of us and that you've found resolution and even to the point of solution to, and that's cancer, Alzheimer's, which in the baby boomer generation now, which is such a large part of the population, is becoming a very significant and top of mind issue. Yeah. You've gone through what it's like and how our system is designed relative to what you experienced when you needed a kidney transplant.
Yeah.
And all of this, did you try to take a political approach to this to try to find resolution? You know, you mentioned you, and that's what I was thinking of earlier. You mentioned even a resolution to the COVID, how we could have cut off not having so many people getting ill and whatnot. You need a political arena, it seems, to be able to make that kind of an impact. Is that where you started before you found out you needed to go private on this?
No, actually, just the opposite. It's been all private. And we're trying to actually get much more of a public recognition of the solutions that we've gotten. And that's where I think I've really struggled. And unfortunately, I've not had the kind of loud enough voice that has been able to resonate and really get these things out there. We've got as far with the COVID-19 solution, which was really, really, it's still very difficult for me because every day I wake up, we know that we've got a solution that would have saved and could have saved tens of thousands of lives literally overnight and hundreds of millions and billions of dollars in state and national treasure because we wasted so much money when we have a very, very simple, straightforward solution in front of us. And I think that probably, and not only that, but also we proposed some of this stuff to several, well, primarily Democratic platform to say, look, we've got a solution. If you just present this to the American people, we're going to have a solution literally overnight that will put calm everybody down, take the pressure off the healthcare system, and immediately have an understanding of exactly where all the hot spots in the system are. Mm-hmm. And the frustration I've had, and I've tried to kind of use our platform, Larry, here that we've got, and we're trying to get word out on social media and stuff like that to try to get in front of the one or two people that can actually understand that we've got a solution here, that it's a simple, very simple, straightforward solution, and that we've got, you know, and it can be implemented literally overnight. Gotcha. But it's the same thing I've come across, and I'll tell you if we get into the story about the kidney program and the heart. If you can put yourself in my shoes, look at what I struggle with. In that, I've got a solution for COVID-19. We've got a solution for this kidney problem. We've got a solution for cancer. And every night I go to bed, I'm going, how stupid am I that I can't seem to get the word out that we've got these things in our hands? And of course, again, you giving me the chance to have this platform and to communicate this with you is one step in that right direction.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm proud and honored to be able to be a part of that, to tell you the truth there. One of the things that was it a bureaucracy issue? Was it was it not being able to get attention with the right people to make the decisions?
It's both. It's okay. Both. So it is both a bureaucracy and, you know, getting in front of the right. And I'll tell you too, that, you know, in the real world where I am, I'm not blind to the fact that there is a lot of not necessarily nefarious intent, but capitalistic intent. And when you've got a situation that we have right now with COVID-19, obviously it's not just a healthcare issue. It is also a massive, massive, massive money grab because the states and the national government, not really having any understanding of what to do, one of the things they can do is just open up the coffers and just say, we'll spend our way out of this solution. We're the United States. We're the biggest, richest, most powerful country in the world. If we don't think it through, we can just buy our way out of this problem. And that is kind of what we're trying to do. And we're going to end up, you know, driving up inflation. We're going to end up having massive, you know, problems with, you know, debt as a result of this, because we did have a simple solution right in front of us. And not only a simple solution, but a solution that would have put the entire population at ease. We wouldn't have the angst and the anxiety that we have right now if we knew that we had a simple, you know, accessible vehicle to managing COVID-19, which we do. And frankly, in the, you know, in the pantheon of potential diseases, this is not the plague or Ebola. Right. Thank God, because if it was, you know, we would really be in trouble. Yes. But we do have this simple solution. It does lead itself to even a bigger, you know, nice thing now that the Democrats are in power, in that it would lay the foundation for a potential easy, inexpensive national healthcare system as well, too. But that is one of the main reasons why we're handling this thing worse than anybody else, The main reason is because we don't have national health care. We don't have, and not that we need national health care for whatever reason, whatever political reason. The problem is with reporting. If all of the people who are sick report to one source, right? You report to one source, we know where that person's coming from and we can track the data. Right now in the United States, when you've got a Latino population in East San Jose that's got a variety of healthcare coverage or no healthcare coverage, or another population of Vietnamese over here, or another population of this over there, they're all getting sick at random places. We have no way of tracking or managing who's getting sick where, because there's no uniform system. And my proposal was basically just to say, hey, why don't we have, look how simple this is, Larry. Why don't we have a 1-800 coronavirus hotline? I have the doctors, I can staff the doctors tomorrow, 2,000 doctors, right? If you're sick, call the hotline. That's it. If you're sick, call the hotline. It's $50 or $60 to talk to a doctor online, right? Sponsored by the state. It has to be a free call, so everybody calls. If you're sick, call the 1-800 California State hotline. Now, the doctors will probably understand, because they're going to be doing the triage, 95% of those calls are probably not going to result in anything. About 5 or 10% will say, hey, sounds like you may actually have the symptoms of COVID-19. Stay home. Let me send you a COVID-19 test. Don't leave the house. Don't go anywhere. Let me send it to you. You spit into a cup, get the result. And then, oh, by the way, if it comes back positive, which will come back in about 48 hours, tell me who else around you has been exposed.
Yeah.
Can you imagine how much money? And now, so I tell everybody, the stupidity of what we're doing right now, we're testing 95% of the population that's not sick. That's where we're spending all our money. And we're doing it every week. How dumb is that? Rather than spending our money only on the 5% that did get sick, or 6% that did get sick. And by the way, don't let them ever leave their house, so you don't put any stress on the healthcare system.
Or the idea to save money is, we'll just go to a university and test the sewage water. Then if we find any COVID in that, then we'll start testing in the university.
Right. Exactly. And I said, as long as all we had to do, and this is the thing that was so frustrating to me, because I had, like I said, I own a telemedicine company, a national telemedicine company. It's the cheapest, most affordable way to bring healthcare. And not only the cheapest, most affordable way, if you have any consideration for first responders, any consideration for a healthcare worker on the front line, don't let a COVID-19 positive person expose them. Let them stay home. Let them stay in their house in their own self-contained little thing. Don't let them expose, you know, the guy at the front desk, or, you know, somebody in the Uber, or three people at the hospital or at the lab, wherever they're going to go get tested. It's one of those things. And when we talk about some of the other issues too, which we'll get into, right. It's such an obvious thing that I almost felt like, okay, as soon as I present this, which was about 3 months ago, as soon as I presented this to Cal HHS, and I actually had to get a lobbying firm to kind of get me up there and talk to, you know, Barbara Lee, talk to Kamala Harris. We talked to all these people. They're like, Ro Khanna. Yeah, Bijan. That's brilliant. Okay, let's tell me, give me a call and we'll set it up and we'll solve the problem. And then everybody else will watch California and the entire country will adopt it. Great. I don't even need to get any recognition. I just want to say, let's stop this so I can go back and play tennis with my friends again. I just want this to be over, right? Yeah. And so, no, not happened. No one's done it yet. And so, but when we talk about these other things like the kidney thing and the cancer thing, you'll see every approach that we take to a major healthcare problem, if you are able to step back for just a bit, take a bit of a breath, right? There is usually, not always, I mean, I'm not saying this is the same thing for everything, but a lot of times you can find a very simple, straightforward path to that solution. At least that's been my thought.
You know, and for the listeners out there, this program that he's put together, SAMMEAID, you know, is, some of you may have heard of concierge doctors, where you're tired of waiting and waiting and waiting to see a doctor. You're not feeling well. And so 2-3 weeks, you finally get an appointment because they're overloaded. The average doctor's maybe got 5,000 to 7,000 patients. So years ago, what they decided to do is they decided to just charge people so much a quarter. And I got involved in it. And then you have access to the doctor. Now the doctor only has 300 patients. You can actually have a doctor spend 45 minutes to an hour on a yearly physical. And some Mine was over 2 hours. I never experienced that in my life, having that much time, except when I was real little and we had a doctor in the neighborhood who'd come to the house. Now I find out about Sammy Aid, it's about half the price. And this is something that's very impressive of the MDVIP program out there. And I'm not saying which one's better or worse, but mostly in healthcare, economics is a pretty key issue. And one thing that I want to give kudos to Bijan about is the fact that he's offering such a phenomenal platform. And those of you that are curious about that, I really encourage you to go to SAMIAID, SAMI-AID. And it's just a beautiful website. It's got all kinds of wonderful information in there, and it's very transparent. You don't have to wonder and go through a bunch of steps to find out how much it's going to cost. It's right up front. And I'm sharing that with you so you begin to recognize the integrity of the gentleman that you're listening to. And when he says something, he's not just spousing things out there that sound wonderful. He's got the rubber has met the road. He's got the vehicle, and you can get in it and you can find yourself in a situation where you've developed a real relationship with that doctor, that healthcare provider, whether it's the nurse or whoever, to get you in the right situation at the right time without the wait. And I wanted to just share that, not as a plug, because I'm very happy with the program that I have because of the relationship I've developed with the doctor. And so I'm willing to pay a little more. Those of you that haven't developed the relationship yet, you can save almost 50% and have the same care. So one thing, though, that I found out about Bijan when I had an opportunity to talk about him before we started this interview was this guy has been there. He has been in a very critical situation in his life, and rather than just be a victim of it, he was very proactive. And I wondered if you wouldn't mind sharing your experience with having a kidney go out on you and what the options were, and then what you ended up doing with that as a result. And I think those of you who are listening will find this fascinating, and it also will empower you, because we all have the power that Bijan had to be able to rectify whatever situation we find ourselves in. Do you mind sharing a little bit of that with us?
Of course, of course. It's a fascinating story, but it's also very indicative of, you know, me, again, as we were saying in the outset, of how do you get exposed to these things? Because I am both a provider and a patient. And obviously I own medical diagnostic imaging centers. I own SAMIAID. We're always constantly giving advice to patients. In particular, at our imaging centers, we tell people, if you're diagnosed with cancer at an early stage, the earlier the diagnosis, the better. Same thing with Alzheimer's. And one of the things I tell people is that you have to be proactive about your care. It's the number one thing, even because a lot of us have insurance as opposed to concierge services. If you've got concierge services, you can pick up the phone and say, I want this, I want that, I want this, I want that. And that's a very, very lucky position to be in. But most people have to be major advocates through their insurance provider, because the insurance companies are not incentivized to treat you. The less care they give you, the more money they make. And the less money they pay the provider, the more money they make. So this is something that I'm really, really, really on board with. When I tell my patients, they say, look, if I tell you you've got cancer, right, I want you to jump up and down and say, I need this, I need that, I need this treatment. So here all of a sudden, I get diagnosed with my own kidney thing. So now I'm in the position of exactly where I tell my patients. So I need to be my own advocate. Fortunately for me,
when did you find out about this? How long ago?
It was in 2011. Okay. I actually I was skiing and I had a ski accident, and I came into the doctor to kind of say, hey, did I hurt something really bad or whatever? They did a blood test and they found that my creatinine level was rising and had been rising for a little bit of time. And they said, okay, look, there's something that's causing this. We need to get a biopsy and find out what's going on. We did a biopsy, found out that I had a genetic disease called IgA nephropathy, which has got its own really interesting, you know, backstory. But this is what the disease I had. And they said, over the next 4 or 5 years, slowly, slowly, your kidney's going to deteriorate and you're going to have to get a kidney transplant. And so obviously for someone who's pretty fit and, you know, never had basically a medical condition my entire life. This is a shock. And I'm like, okay. As a matter of fact, I remember my cousin is a doctor and he's the one that gave me the news and he walked in all somber. And I thought he was going to tell me I was going to die. He goes, no, but the reason why he was so somber is that he knew the statistics that I didn't know at the time, that dialysis in the United States or anywhere in the world is basically a 1 foot in the grave existence. Mm-hmm. It is an awful existence, no matter how it's represented anywhere in the world. For people that are on dialysis, it's terrible. It is a terrible, terrible situation. If you've got a little bit of a family behind you, it's less terrible. But if you don't have family support, you are awful. You're in awful mm-hmm. shape. So the first thing that they told me was, at no cost, do not consider dialysis an option. So I'm like, okay. Wow. That's, geez. I mean, I didn't know it was that bad. So I'm like, okay, I'll get a transplant. Then I found out in California, the waiting list for transplant is 7 years and I'd be close to like number 70 or 80,000 on that transplant list. Right. So I'm going, well, what do I do while I wait for a transplant? They go, oh, you got dialysis. And I'm just like, but I was told under no circumstances should I get dialysis. So now I begin this
journey. Why were they so adamantly opposed to dialysis?
It's the impact on your quality of life. That's what it is.
Just the constant, time it takes.
Right. The time it takes, the burden that it does to your body. You go through these massive builds up in toxicity in your blood, and then you get a cleanse. Then you get a buildup in toxicity and then a cleanse. And that just wreaks havoc on your organ system. And
so what's the intent of that? What is, in layman's terms, what are they attempting to accomplish through that dialysis?
The only thing they're trying to accomplish is to delay you dying until you get a kidney. That's the only thing you're doing. That's the only thing. And as a matter of fact, it's interesting you bring up that point, Larry, because when dialysis was first invented, right?
Okay.
It was actually not available to the masses. It was under the Nixon administration when it was actually approved and made available in the United States. And people were starting to say, well, can everybody have this? Well, Nixon, you know, was like, well, look, why don't we make it available to everybody? It'll be covered. There's not that many people doing it. There wasn't the obesity epidemic that we have right now back in the early 70s. Nobody thinking that many people would actually access the technology, given that it was kind of expensive. But before kidney transplant, there was no other option. So people were going to die and that was going to be it, right? So they said, let's open it up to the other people that need it. They'll have it for a couple of years and then they all die because everybody died after being on dialysis for a couple of years. So Nixon says, let's have a few people use it. Then about the late 70s, early 80s, transplant becomes an option. So people are thinking that, hey, great, transplant's here. Why don't we just transplant everybody and we won't need dialysis anymore. But also a significantly interesting thing happened there, both in my story and also in the story of kidney transplants in general. Ronald Reagan gets elected. He comes in with a group of people called the Moral Majority, as you can probably well remember.
Oh, yeah.
The Moral Majority have an agenda. Their agenda basically is to reverse abortion. And they have this very conservative agenda they come into thing. And Reagan is a supporter of this this agenda. This idea of what to do with kidney transplant. Well, all the doctors are like, oh my God, we've got one of the biggest breakthroughs in the world. We will solve a major problem. Kidney transplant is a major issue. The world's going to follow us. Let's figure out a compensation system so that just like when you give blood or any other tissue, you get compensated and people are all happy and let's work it out. And this is where the story is very interesting too. So under the Moral Majority, they decide no, kidney transplant cannot be reimbursed. And so as a result, you end up having almost nobody donating kidneys. There is no kidney donation unless you're a family member, you're not seeing it. And so the miracle of kidney transplant falls fallow for almost the entire world based on the lead by the United States because the technology was developed here, except for one country. One country is like the Australia of medicine in terms of evolutionary terms. They've got this wild, weird development. Which country was it? Back in the early 1980s, one country was excluded from the international community. It was Iran. Because of the Iran hostage crisis, they got, you know, blanked by everybody. Nobody else was allowed to do anything. And so now Iran is isolated from the entire world. Now, Iran also has a very strong, you know, medical history. They've got very good doctors and things like that, but they do not have access to dialysis equipment. And they're like, well, we are understanding this kidney revolution is happening. So nobody else is doing this, but we're going to go ahead and do this. So let's figure out what we're going to do.
Let me just mention something in a moment.
Yeah.
As soon as you bring up Iran, what comes to people's minds? What's the listeners thinking about now? And it depends on how old they are and what kind of history they have.
Right.
But there's never been a very positive picture that's been painted. And, you know, we all have our experience with that. So here you have the moral majority, and they are not into people paying for organs, correct?
Right. Right.
Was there any reasoning behind that other than just a sense?
It was actually based on, when I go back and look at the history, right, their primary agenda was to reverse Roe versus Wade. That was the abortion issue was kind of on the table.
Okay.
They didn't seem to be able to get to that. So this became kind of a secondary issue that they were able to get to a kind of appease, you know, their audience. But it was not based on any scientific rationale at all. Okay. 100%, it was a moral decision. And as a result, the whole rest of the world was impacted by this, and millions of people have died as a result. In Iran, it wasn't that they didn't have any less of a moral situation that was presented to them. Had they been part of the international community, they probably would have followed suit along with everybody else. Gotcha. But because they were isolated and did not have access to dialysis equipment, they had no choice. So they had no choice. They said, okay, we can't get dialysis equipment. We have this transplant technology. Why don't we go ahead and set up an NGO that would be kind of a intermediary so we can kind of set a price for organs for people who want to donate, but make it cost effective enough for Iranians to be able to afford it.
So now, was this the black market kind of concern too, that people would have? Now people will be paying $60,000 to $100,000 for an organ, and all of a sudden healthy people are giving up their organs just for the sake of money instead of to save a life. Did that get involved in that as well?
Absolutely. And this is where, you know, Larry, this whole story is really grist for a major documentary. It is a fascinating story.
Oh, I can imagine. And the buttons it pushes.
On every front, right?
You bet.
So the black market is really fascinating in that the black market itself is controlled by a group of people, right? Where there's, you know, obviously you can get black market kidneys. I explored all this stuff. These are all things that I explored in the Philippines, India, in China, a number of different places you can actually look for black market kidneys, right? And so this is where, and the price is $60,000 to $150,000, but very similar to the time before abortion was legal. You know, if you are rich enough and willing to take the risk, you could probably get the medical treatment that you needed. And same thing here. It's absolutely fraught with risk. You give somebody money, you don't know what you're getting. And after going through the process myself, legally in Iran, where they have a pay-for-play program, it was, you wouldn't believe it. It's so straightforward. It's almost like going getting your oil changed at the gas station. It is that easy of a process. I mean, it is so unbelievably easy. And of course, given that it's so easy, and once I go over the cost, what it cost me to do this and the time, not only the cost in money, but also the cost in time, you're going to be blown away. If we compare what I did with what people are going through right now by the millions around the world. Again, it's one of those ones where I have difficulty sleeping at night because it's such an obvious solution. So as we get into these things, like I say, you can see the kind of, you know, anxiety that I have because I am aware of a solution that is so straightforward, so obvious, so easy that nobody else in the world is implementing. Now, not to say, again, I haven't done something about it. I do speak up. I've spoken to the National Kidney Foundation. I've spoken to the president of the National Kidney Foundation. When I got back, I've got connections all over. And I said, okay, let's try to change this. This is not right. I can't go back to Kaiser and look at all those people in that room that 19 out of 20 of them are either on dialysis or are dead and come back and go, look at me. I feel like a month after I got back, I climbed Half Dome. 1 month after I got back. You know, and it was because of one, I got the kidney, and two, when I did get back, we do have world-class immunosuppression here that I have with Kaiser and UCSF. So we do have medicine that is very, very effective and the best in the world. Is it efficient? Is it accessible? Is it available? Are we doing the right thing all the time? No, unfortunately. And sometimes you need guys like you and me to kind of go, that's not right.
Yeah.
I'm not a genius doctor, like I said, from Harvard, but I can look at a system and go, how did it only cost me 2 weeks of my time and about $10,000, including business class airfare, right? And I got a kidney and came back. And of course, this is after
you weren't arrested when you got off the plane.
And I was, as a matter of fact, when I was in that hospital in Iran, I was actually concerned at some point that somebody was going to come back and go, hey, wait a second, you've got an American passport. I think we're going to take that kidney back and, you know, go back in there.
This is one of the biggest challenges all of us face is this concept called fear. It's an illusion, not unlike danger, which is a reality. Danger is something that, you know, a tiger runs into your room, you're in danger. A growl outside or imagining that there's a tiger outside, that's fear. And the fear that has been imposed upon all of us from something as simple as cheating on a test and you'll be ridiculed for the rest of your life and you're only a fourth grader for crying out loud.
Yes.
To the fact that you're going to a country, you know, that a lot of Americans despise, and they begin to lose sight of, let's keep this into perspective. This is not about politics. This is not about religion. This is about the quality of someone's life. And yet what we've done is allowed religion and politics to determine what one is able to do to retain the quality of their own life. And I'm not going to get into it any more than you are on discussing the pros and cons of the politics or the religion, because we know that's a rabbit hole. I don't want to alienate listeners. I want listeners to ask themselves, where are the fears that I have that are holding me back? You know, I got comfortable with a doctor who wasn't in agreement with some of the things I wanted to do with my body. And I got tired of the conflict.
Yes.
So I finally had to find another doctor. And, you know, and then you got to explain, why are you finding another doctor? Well, what business is that of you?
Exactly. Exactly. You know?
But yeah,
you're the consumer. You're the one paying the bills.
You know, and I think that all of us recognize we want simplicity and we want effectiveness and we want it to be efficient. And we want it transparent. I don't want to have to wonder afterwards, did I do the right thing? Because of this propaganda over here, or this program over here, or this person said this and that person said that. You mentioned earlier how important it is that we become in control of our own health.
Right.
And right. Once we make that decision, do we begin to see hypocrisy everywhere? You know, and hypocrisy can be very subtle.
Yeah.
When I turned around when my children were young and I yelled at them to stop yelling.
Yeah.
That's hypocrisy.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
It was my wife that had to turn around and say, could you please speak quieter voice? And I'm going, damn, why didn't I say that? But what you're sharing here is can be perceived as volatile, but it can also be perceived as, what am I doing with my life? How am I making my decisions? But more importantly, who is making my decisions? And so you decided to take charge and take control, and you found another world out there. And that's what excites me, to be able to offer people these kinds of opportunities to hear from people that are courageous. They're not necessarily, and I'm not saying you're not a genius, but you don't have to have something you don't already possess to be able to take over your own decision-making relative to your health.
And Larry, let me tell you one thing that I love about what you just said there too, is that I think, you know, one of the great attributes of people that I respect, right, is the ability to be introspective, right? And look at yourself, not just from, you know, look at yourself from the inside out first. Look at how you are, what your problems are, and see if that can relate to somebody else. And just like you said about a child, I've had the same thing with my daughter. And when I will look at her and I'll tell her something and I'll kind of go, hey, you know what? If I was in her shoes, how would I react to what I just said to her? Is it fair? Is it not fair? And of course, I think by doing that, that makes me a better parent, you know? Absolutely. And of course, parenting, like anything else, there's no manual for it. And just like life, there's no manual for life. And Absolutely. All I can do is when I look at these problems that are there, and I try to be open-minded and rational. And this is one of my favorite things when I talk to anybody that I talk to, whether they're brilliant scientists or politicians or business people. And I say, hey, look, listen to what I'm saying with an open mind. Now, if you tell me something different, if I see a better model, I'm going to change my opinion on something. I'm not stuck with anything. I want to see a better model. But I think one of the reasons why I'm able to come up with these solutions is because I do have an open mind. Not all of them are from me. Right. I look at something and I go, oh my God, that's a great model. Why are we not using that model? That Iranian model is brilliant. It should be adopted by the rest of the world. It should be adopted tomorrow. And the only reason why it's not is what you're saying is political reasons. There's
the name of the model, right?
Right. Correct. Right. Right. We call it the Trump model. It'd have been here like 3 years ago. But anyway, those are the things that we're kind of like struggling with and trying to figure out. But, you know, I think, you know, at the end of the day, when I look at any problem, like I said, as long as we have a rational approach, especially in medicine, right? I do listen to what my doctors are telling me. Of course, I'm in the medical field, and I do hear people get like, you know, very concerned about how far afield from traditional medicine should you go, right? Because there are people that go way, way out there. And I have in the cancer field, we do cancer treatment and Alzheimer's treatment. Those are the two things that we do. And one of the things that SAMEAID was invented for was not only to say that we wanted to bring transparent, available medicine to the masses, we also wanted to be able to bring breakthrough medicine. But not the kind of medicine that maybe people think. They go, well, what about crystals and, you know, holistic this and that? And there are, you know, people have some benefit from that, I'm sure. But we tend to go with a very, very scientific rationale. If I can't see clinical evidence of something, or if I can't prove clinically that something is effective, we don't advocate for it. And so, and mostly because the people that I'm dealing with, like for example, I'll give you the example, Alex Trebek just died from pancreatic cancer. We reached out to him about 4 months ago. I called his manager down in LA and I said, look, we've got a cancer treatment that's gonna save his life. He goes, okay, great, what is it? And I told him what our program was. And he goes, okay, I'll talk to Alex. All right. So Alex is like, okay. He didn't get on the phone with me, but I called him a couple of days later and I said, how come we haven't heard back from Alex? We need to treat him now. He's stage 4 pancreatic. The doctors that are on my team are world-class pancreatic doctors. We need to go with this particular therapy. And his doctors are like, well, we've never heard of that before. So we're not going to let Alex do it, or we're not going to convince Alex to do it. Yeah. If he had done our therapy, he'd be alive today.
Yeah.
Simple as that. If he had done our therapy, he'd be alive today. And I'm a huge Jeopardy guy. And this was actually a mission for me. And I really wanted to treat him. And unfortunately, you know, again, my voice has not been strong enough or loud enough to show that that particular treatment would have been effective right at that moment.
You've made many powerful statements, but two of them just recently were, we haven't heard of that before. Okay. Just think of that sentence. Think about the statement. Think about the impact that that has on so many people, you know, and this fact that we haven't heard about it before precludes this concept that you talked about that I wanted to get into a little more, which is the fact that you considered yourself open-minded. Now, in the business and the work that I do in neuropsychology, open-mindedness is an oxymoron. Okay, like jumbo shrimp. The two words don't go together because when you think about it, the only thing we're open to is everything we agree with.
That's true.
That's 95% of people. And in order to be open-minded, you nailed it when you said introspection. You have to be able to take a look at yourself. And awareness is the first step to any kind of therapy, any kind of treatment, any kind of insights or aha, right, is to not be, to rethink, I haven't heard of that before. And I would suggest with the work that you've done is that, you know, the first thing that freaked those people out is you had a solution, which immediately says that they don't, and everything they've been doing has been wrong up to this point in time. That's which was not true. Your intent at all, was it?
Right. No, absolutely. No. But you're exactly right.
Right. But we end up without wanting to. We create defensivenesses, and then people defend an indefensible position. You know, and that decision is to not do anything or to stay this on the path we're on. Don't change horses in the middle of the stream. You know, we've heard all of these little cliches that begin to dictate what we allow ourselves to believe. Just when you brought up the Iran solution, it'd be interesting to find out what percentage of people would even listen any further.
Right.
And so the groundbreaking work that you're doing is one of the things that's going to be so important to you is to begin to share information differently. You know, that my program is called Apernio, and Apernio is a hybrid of two terms. The aperture of the camera is how the image gets in.
Right.
And the Neo in Latin is a new perspective. So it's all about looking at the same differently, but it's our job, your job and my job, to allow people to look at the same differently. And that requires us to use different terminology and different words, because you have opened me up to some of the blind spots, or that Greek term scotoma, that I have built to so many things without even knowing it, because I pay attention to myself. Mm-hmm. You know, as you're talking to, and remember this, because you know this very well, as I'm talking to you, you're talking to you. Mm-hmm. And generally three times as fast. And decisions are made before we even allow the information to come in. Mm-hmm. And so here you have an opportunity. And I hope the listeners out there recognize whatever might be holding them back from finding out more of what you've got to share is only going to fold them back from finding out more about how to have a better life.
Right.
And is that really what we want to hold ourselves back to?
Well, and especially when your whole life is at stake, it's a completely different. When something bad is going to happen, you've got to have an open mind. Like I said, you have to be an advocate, yeah, or you've got to listen, one or the other.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so what are you most excited about right now that you're dealing with and working on?
Well, you know, honestly, if we could get this COVID-19 solution, you know, on board, I mean, like I said, we have access, or we thought we had some access to Kamala Harris, because she does come from our area up in San Francisco. Sure. And so the COVID-19 thing would be the number one thing that I would say that would, because it brings anxiety to all of us. But yeah, like I said, what's beautiful about that solution is that it does two things. Not only will it solve the COVID-19 problem literally overnight, but it does lay the foundation for something very, very, very important for all Americans, but a very cheap, accessible, affordable healthcare plan, which is just say, hey, look, we don't need to put national healthcare on every street corner. We don't. If we want to do something that's a 21st century solution, let it be a telemedicine access. It's not going to be very expensive. But if you get a poor family in East San Jose that's got three kids and the mom's at home and the kids need some kind of care and all they've got is Medi-Cal, they can't go through the machinations of even getting that. But if you can just say, hey, pick up the phone, the kid's got an earache, let's just get him some earache antibiotic and medication. It's nothing. Go ahead and get his earache. If you don't treat his earache, he might go deaf in that ear. And now he's going to be a burden to society kind of going all the way forward. It's a simple, simple, very, very, very compassionate solution, but it's also a very practical solution. Yeah. So that's probably the thing that I'm most, now you might sit there and go, Bijan, why not? You can cure cancer. You can cure Alzheimer's. Aren't those even more exciting than this? You've come up with a cure for kidney disease. All those are great. But right now, in the moment, the COVID-19 thing is more important to probably everybody's lives than anything else. And the cancer thing is going to be there. We have cancer treatments for people. This particular solution that we have, it'll it'll bankrupt probably a lot of companies, because our solution, again, just like everything else, is very simple, very straightforward. And I will tell you, clinically proven. Nothing that I say or I do is not got a clinical basis for its validation. And I think that's the thing that I feel most comfortable when we talk about the programs that we are all advocating for. They are clinically proven to be successful. And so it's not like I'm just, you know, making it up and going, hey, just give it a try and see what happens. It's worth it. You know, it's not that. We know that it'll work, and we know that it does work, you know, so.
Yeah. Fantastic. Outstanding. All right. So as an entrepreneur, as an individual who figured out how to go about creating something that you could be passionate about and made a difference, which is kind of the ultimate in everybody's life. Everybody would love to do that. If you could go back to the 18-year-old that you once were, knowing that what you know now, what advice would you give yourself?
You know, I think at 18, I was very, I don't know how everybody else is, I just know me. I was very curious about the way my life was going to unfold. And I was actually impatient to get to where I wanted to be. I didn't know what the path was. And I was scared because I didn't know what the path was. I felt like I would eventually get to a place where I could make a difference, but I was afraid that that might never happen, that I would have, you know, an idea. I didn't want to be somebody who couldn't make a contribution. I knew that I did. I was working for, obviously, when I got out of college, I was looking at getting into medicine. I ended up not going to medical school. I got an MBA for Northwestern. I worked for a couple of corporations. And at some point I was like, look, you know, I think it's important. And maybe not everybody has the same ambition, but I know that I did, but I wanted to be able to have, to make a difference in the world. I did want to be able to kind of say that I felt like I would have solutions. I didn't know what those would be, but I wanted to be at least be, you know, one day be on a podcast like this with you, Larry, and be able to communicate right. That I have a solution. Back then, if I had to give myself advice, I would just say, trust the process. It's going to happen. If you have that vision of what you want to yourself to be, somehow magically the light, you get guided to the light. You just have to keep on wondering where the twists and turns are going to take you. And are you going to be, at one point I was living in Kearney, Nebraska, and I'm sitting there going, boy, how did I end up here? I mean, you know, and of course I ended up loving my time in Kearney. Kearney was fantastic, but it was a stepping stone to eventually, you know, coming out here and having my own businesses and things like that in San Francisco, but, and meeting the people that I have.
You sound like a man of faith to me. And what I mean by that is faith is defined as a belief in that which is yet unseen. And so the advice you gave yourself as an 18-year-old is to just enjoy what you're witnessing and envisioning now, because it's the steps it's going to take for you to arrive. And one of the things that you had is you had a positive outcome for yourself as far as making a positive impact and making a difference, which you certainly are. You know, it's been a pleasure. It's been an honor to have you on and to just pick your brain just a little bit to see what's going on inside of that that creates the wonderments. And I also very much appreciate your lack of ego and your humility. I think that makes you so refreshing, so interesting, and doggone it, you know, your compassion is contagious. I think all of us, after listening to this, that we want to make a difference. And even if that's in how we put breakfast together for our family this morning, or how we bring our mind to the work that we're doing, even if it's not something that we have the most passionate about, we get to make a difference and an influence on the people that are around us. And Bijan, you've certainly done that for us. And I encourage everyone to follow more about what he's up to and get online and take a look at his site and, make a difference, make a positive difference in your life. What would you like to say to kind of wrap things up in this first interview with you and I?
Well, you know, whatever people are seeing in terms of anxiety with the world and what's going on and stuff like that, I think the biggest thing that is encouraging to me is that people like me, people like you, Larry, in today's age of social media and stuff like that, every voice counts. just like every vote has counted in this last election. Yeah. I mean, people can make a difference. And I think that when you see a system that doesn't seem to be, you know, working for you in some way, the best thing you can possibly do is not stand by and just accept the terms of what's being offered to you, but try to speak up, offer a solution, and like people will get together. Like people are at the end of the day, that's what makes our country special, is that we allow people to think freely. We allow our people to speak, you know, their mind. And when I have the opportunity to speak with a wonderful man like you, and we have a chance to share some really, really strong ideas, we can build a coalition that can actually make some change happen. A lot of places in the world that doesn't exist. But yeah, here in the United States, the great thing about our country and our democracy and our freedom that we have here is that we are allowed to make those things happen. And even if we have a situation we don't like, we have the ability to change it. It might take a long time, yep, and it might frustrate us, but yep, we actually have a vehicle to make it happen. And again, it might not happen on the schedule that we all like, but eventually it can get there. And I'm encouraged by that, to at least be able to express ourselves.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. I knew it was going to be engaging, and it certainly was.
We could have turned this into a mini series, Larry.
That's right. Absolutely. Well, I hope we could do another one together, because sure, I think we just peeled a little bit of the onion. Yeah. But anyway, I want to thank all the listeners, and I want you to recognize that you're in the absolutely right spot you need to be in right now, and you're observing what's going on in your life to get you where you want to be. And take advantage of every opportunity that you have. And remember, if you don't know where you want to be, you need to figure that out as quickly as you can. You need to ask yourself, what is going to make me feel best about myself? And then you're able to take advantage of what's going on in your life right now. Just as Bijan has been a beautiful example of that. And he's getting so close. I'm sure he's much closer than he thinks he is to getting the exposure and getting the type of people that can assist him in making that impact he so much wants to make and is making. So thanks again for being on, and all the best to you. And I look forward to our next visit together.
Thank you, Larry.
You're so welcome.
Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, we ask that you please subscribe and share with your friends and associates. Our next guest is McGuire Heston, who currently works for Amazon Web Services, running their Global Thought Leadership Program. McGuire's warm and inviting personality and ability to make a positive impact on the identity and growth of a startup, as well as Apernio, puts her in a class of her own. Join Larry and McGuire to discover the power of why, that clarity is always preferred over cleverness, and that you don't have to be nice, but you do have to be kind. You'll truly love this one.